Welcome back to your favorite Phillies podcast, The Dirty Inning. I'm Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight. With me is Dr. Trevor Strunk, and together we go back in time. Together we go back in time and try to get our entrance right for this podcast. But time and time again, perfection eludes us once more.
I feel like we were really close maybe 6 or 7 months ago. And since then, we've kind of backslid.
Yeah, it hasn't been great. I felt like we were turning a corner there, but once again, we have plummeted into mediocre at best, which isn't going to surprise any of our regular listeners to this podcast, which again, I need to explain, is a podcast in which we go back in time and just take a look around, you know, take in our surroundings, typically at a Phillies game, where something ridiculous, obscure, or insane has happened. And we just kind of zero in on an inning in which that occurred. This time, Trev, I got to get your take on this a little bit. We're doing a holiday episode here before the end of the All-Star break. And the 4th of July has come and gone, and we've addressed that in a timely fashion.
Very timely.
Baseball has had its mid-season. We've seen the home run derby. We've seen the All-Star game. Trev, the All-Star game. Moving along. I feel like the All-Star game is a very fun summer exhibition, but man, this year it just seemed like everyone used it as an opportunity to talk about how much they think baseball sucks. What do you think?
Yeah, I think they do that. I think that happens a lot. Like, I feel like every time there's like a special baseball thing, half the time you just end up, you know, it'll be like hashtag baseball fest, and everyone will be like, wow, this sport really has gone downhill, hashtag happy baseball fest.
Back in my day, baseball fest was only for the 9 best players. Now they'll let anybody in. The sport's ruined.
Hashtag happy
baseball fest. Happy baseball fest.
I don't know. Like, people were pretty upset about it. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that was leaked, I guess. We sort of got the first hints of how bad labor strife might end up being. There was a couple of like leaked things saying like, oh yeah, everyone in baseball wants to strike. That was something that came out during this All-Star break. There was, basically everyone complaining about how many home runs are being hit, about the current commissioner. I feel like it's no more complaining than usual, but it just happened all at once. Like, basically everyone was like, okay, get it all out now. And it just kind of flew.
That's true. We used the All-Star break to let the diarrhea of the mouth kind of just spew across the sport. It just made it a little less enjoyable, but it was just another one of those instances where you remember that, hey, this is the All-Star game. It's for children to enjoy. And anytime you want to, you can just stop being on social media. So if you're someone who is upset that the baseballs are now hollow, that Rob Manfred is denying that, that there's a labor stoppage in our increasingly immediate future, you know, you don't have to be swimming in that for the entirety of the evening. If you're like me and you have the object permanence of a dog, you can just watch the game and feel like, you know, good emotions from that happening. JT Realmuto didn't really get to do a whole lot, the Phillies' sole all-star. I see that his at-bat seemed to be cut short by both a pop-up and an in-game head and shoulders ad. Felt like that was, I was going to say appropriate, but it shouldn't be like that anymore. Kind of told me this is exactly the treatment the Phillies All-Star has received for the last 6 years when the Phillies have sent only one All-Star to the All-Star game, that they're just sort of in the background. They're not really in any of the promotional materials. But it was supposed to be different this year, that the Phillies had not just their own talent that like got sniffed out by someone who had to put a Philly on the All-Star team. They had league-recognized talent all over
this team.
This wasn't
supposed to be a Ricky Pitalico year, basically.
I mean, it was just, it wasn't supposed to be a Pat Neshek year. Let's go with that. Because, you know, Pat Neshek still on the Phillies. But There just seems like there was more talent on this team, and you know, that's a matter of, yeah, the Phillies didn't do great going into the All-Star break as far as like Bryce Harper, as far as Gene Segura, as far as the guys who they required to be good, to be really good. So those numbers have been a little lower, but still, Realmuto was there. Everybody knows he's one of the he is the best catcher in the league. It's not for the sexiest of topic or statistics right now, but he does an important job. And I mean, God, in Philly, isn't that what they love about guy? Oh, a guy who's quiet, puts his head down, works really hard, has no personality. Oh no, suddenly we also need him to cartwheel up to the plate with sparklers between his toes. I mean, pick a side. I forget what I was talking about. The point is, the All-Star game,
just keep going.
The All-Star game has come and gone, and if you think people were complaining a lot, you know, in this last segment, but also during the entire All-Star break, think about how much people would be complaining if on July 4th, America's birthday, the Phillies played a doubleheader against the dreaded Braves and lost both games by a lot of runs.
Ooh, no, that's not good.
It wasn't good. It was very, very bad. And on July 4th, 1947, Trev, that's exactly what happened.
Now, in 1947, the Braves weren't as hated as the Braves are of today. I'm assuming, because you're talking about the two, like, you're talking about National League, American League, sort of like winning the pennant and going to the World Series that way. Like, it wasn't like it's a dogfight in the NL East quite yet. This is still Milwaukee or Boston Braves?
This was Boston.
Not even Milwaukee Braves.
Right. This is the team, I forget the year of this other episode we did, but this is definitely, I think, the team, it has to be, that painted their seats green and didn't wait for them to dry, and then people sat in them.
Such a classic one. Yes.
And then they had to play a game in Fenway Park because they still weren't sure if they dried by the next time the team had a homestand. Just
listen,
great.
It was just, it's an honest mistake. Who among us? But no, I mean, I can't imagine it was ever good to lose a doubleheader in such embarrassing fashion on July 4th.
Yeah, it couldn't have upped morale a whole lot. I feel like everybody was pretty excited for July 4th around Philadelphia. And one of the reasons for that excitement, especially in Philadelphia, was because it was 1947, man. World War II was over. Philadelphia was ready to jet into the future. Something we learned by watching the Better Philadelphia exhibition, which was the product of a bunch of young architects and city planners and a bunch of prominent citizens liked what these people were planning, and they funded this campaign for them, and they got to show off all their plans for the future of Philadelphia in the Gimbel's department store in Center City. An exhibition in which 350,000 people, all from the Philadelphia region, came in, paid nothing, and got to see what their city could look like in the years to come. Sounds pretty cool.
Neat. Did it happen?
So did it explode and everyone die, you ask?
Yeah, that is, you know my questions. I was going to actually ask if the city looked like it did, like like they thought it would.
Well, it did and it didn't. I mean, by the end of World War II, it was actually a period. We've talked about American cities, the state of American cities. I think it was an episode that took place in the 90s. We talked about how Philadelphia had been through a period of decay and needed to be revitalized. And by the end of World War II, a lot of American cities were kind of crumbling a bit. And this was sort of the dawn of a lot more urban redevelopment programs. So New York, Boston, for some reason, New Haven, Connecticut, all the big places on the East Coast were really, blowing up.
It's a classic city.
But they got to see sculptures and light shows and information about what exactly it is urban planners do. So I mean, yeah, it's the 40s, so, you know, 350,000 people heard about an exhibit in a department store, and they all came to see it because they heard it was free. And meanwhile, the guy there is like, hi, I'm an urban planner. And some people were probably like, that is a job. Wow, I have been jarring mayonnaise, and my grandfather's jarred mayonnaise, and his grandfather jarred mayonnaise. But apparently we could have just been making models of cities the entire time. And no one told me because I was out there.
It was the birth of the nation's first mayonnaise planner. They're like, well, I know I have a better title for what I bring to the table.
Well, the highlight of this exhibition was what the Philadelphia Encyclopedia calls an elaborate 30-by-14-foot diorama of Philadelphia that served as the centerpiece. Spotlights focused on specific areas of the city and portions of the diorama, then mechanically flipped over to reveal their imagined future. And in the years that followed, many of the diorama's notable features, Trev, did become reality, including the removal of the Pennsylvania Railroad's viaduct, popularly referred to as a Chinese wall. Sorry, I don't know if that's offensive.
I don't think that's good.
You gotta watch. It's the 40s.
I think you could say that.
People were terrible. A new three-block-long mall north of Independence Hall, and a Delaware Riverfront yacht basin and promenade, and new housing in the far northeast, which became home to a lot of angry fathers, I've learned.
Oh. Yeah. Weird.
So, yeah, Trev, did you ever meet one of your friends' dads from northeast Philadelphia? Not a lot of calm men.
No, northeast Philadelphia is a pretty angry place. That's pretty true.
Pretty cranked up there. So
they get mad.
They get mad. Yeah. So we got to look into the future, Trev, in the 40s. And I don't know, we're sitting here in 2019 recording a podcast about how stupid baseball is. Do you feel like we've let down our predecessors who had such high hopes for the future?
Man, can you imagine if they knew how we were doing this? Like, they knew we were still talking about the Phillies, and we'd taken it so far as to not just go to the game and boo them, but complain about them with decades of hindsight and with such particularity that we needed to schedule an hour to discuss one inning. They'd be so proud of us.
I'd hate us. I kind of do hate us. Every time we do one of these.
Of course we hate ourselves, Justin. Everyone knows.
So it was a time of rebirth in Philadelphia as the old ways were kicked to the curb and a people became in search of the new normal. At Scheib Park, however, things were pretty much the same.
Ooh.
As you might have guessed based on our introduction. But also happening in Philadelphia right now, Trev, death!
Yes. So, I mean, oh no.
so much death.
What happened?
Yellow fever
come through?
We've covered the yellow fever epidemic, Trev. This was not that. This was, instead of one sweeping epidemic of a single cause of death, was more like a scattershot of fatalities across the region.
Oh, no.
Independence Day was a veritable bloodbath in the cradle of liberty, and the following day's newspaper did not hold back in relaying all of them. Trev, there were 10 drownings, 6 deaths in plane crashes, 2 kids were killed by firecrackers, a parade director committed suicide by borrowing a policeman's revolver in a police station.
You reached for the cop's gun?
No, he borrowed it. He asked for it, and he gave it to him.
See, you can't do that.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how else to take that. I can't imagine. I know we're talking about a pretty facetious era of journalism, but that seemed to be restricted to the sports pages. We're talking about, I can't believe a journalist would be like, a man who shot himself in the head in a police station with a policeman's gun, borrowed it, and like that was a slang for stealing it. I don't know. Maybe that's the case, but it did sound like the even more confusing scenario of, hey, let me see that. Thanks.
If someone asks you to borrow your revolver, and you know they you're in a police station together, I don't think you should give it to them.
What's the worst that could happen? Yes, that.
I think, like, it's one of those situations where you can't ask yourself what's the worst that could happen. You only can ask yourself what's the best that could happen. And really, it's like the best that could happen is still really bad.
What's certainly going to happen? That's kind of the question you need to ask.
He could just loudly comment on how good the gun is and get in more trouble.
Well, any loud commenting fell on literal deaf ears in the case of a deaf and mute adult illegally driving a vehicle down the street that knocked down a 17-year-old. One of the walkways at Wildwood collapsed, injuring 40 people. Three more people were killed in car wrecks, adding to the recent car fatality total of 15. And if that wasn't enough, the Philadelphia Inquirer reminded us of ongoing global conflicts by listing not only the 234 nationwide deaths from firecrackers, as well as the headline, Grim Specter of War Stalks Holiday Celebration.
Yay!
Hooray! Trev, I mean, 15 is, I guess it seems like a lot, but also not many, but also a sizable amount over the period of a couple of days in the city. But I think this is a period where you got to remember cars were basically just trash cans with wheels on them. You had to crawl inside and barely control. And if there was any sort of impact, you were thrown several miles into the next district.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, you're looking at the deaths happening from retrospect, and it's like at the time you're looking at that and you're like, oh geez, we've already had these 15 deaths. Is it going to be 75 deaths by next week? You're thinking ahead, and it just seems so crazy. They would be happy, I think, if you told them it would stop at 15.
This is also a time when absolutely everything seemed to be getting caught up in the newspaper, where it was literally just a reflection of the community. I mean, I've read documents where people by name were listed just like what they were up to that weekend. So I wanted to ask, I mean, is this a sizable list of fatalities to occur in one metropolitan area, or is this just a more detailed recording of those fatalities?
That's a very good question. I think probably it's...
That's why I'm asking you, newspaper archivist Trevor Strunk.
Well, yeah, I did get my PhD in reporting deaths in newspapers. Yeah, I would think it's just very detailed and probably a little scandalized, like a little bit like gussied up to sell papers. But, I mean, you could probably take any city and say, like, okay, how many people died today? And in any year, it's going to be bad. And in 1947, it's going to be bad. And it's going to be like, you know, John Smith died from too many pincers on his tongue for removing a boil that could have caused buboes. Like, it's just like it's truly like incredibly, or like, you know, riding a bucket down the street in a game that everyone recognizes as important to the 4th of July. Like, it's just, it was a crazy time.
Well, speaking of crazy times, there was, oh man, what a wacky city we live in. There was an incident between 82nd and 84th Streets in which the horses owned by a man named Edward Montgomery in Southwest Philadelphia started in what could only have been this journalist's dream story to cover, because he used the phrase horsing around in the first several sentences. They awesome. Somehow busted loose from their stables and ran into the streets just before 10 a.m., according to the paper, just as the great rush of holiday traffic was at its height. Five of them and a pony. You can only assume the pony was talked into this mischief by five troublemaking horses.
Yeah.
10 minutes later, they had run into traffic and caused such a traffic jam. According to the paper, four busloads of people who had gathered at 87th Street and Earwig Avenue in the fond belief.
Earwig?
I know. I love it too. I don't think it exists anymore.
I was gonna say, I've been to Philly many times. I don't think I've really.
What a hideous name for a road. But four busloads of people who, in the fond belief that they were going to a picnic in New Jersey, which, if you're going to have a fond belief, you can't do much better than a picnic eating outdoors in the Garden State, found themselves in a field to which the bus drivers had diverted when the thundering herd came galloping along. But yeah, there eventually a patrolman named John Flynn was named the hero. He was he showed up and he kind of nudged them into a group and then, you know, not lassoed but herded them into a nearby field. But then they ran from one side of the road to the other, and it was about an hour before he was able to really group them all together. And
so good.
He was this John Flynn. He had been a gunner on an army plane during the World War II, and he said it was easier being a gunner on an army plane. When you got a plane, it was got. So shooting down Nazi aircraft, an easier task than rounding up five horses and a pony in Philadelphia.
I don't like that someone admitted that capturing horses was actually easier than being in war, or harder than being in war. It really shows the thin veneer of our society and how much horse based chaos there is just waiting under the surface.
Speaking of chaos, I couldn't let this slip by. The Associated Press reported. this was in Milwaukee. I'm sorry. I thought this was also in Philadelphia, but this did happen in Milwaukee. And a 73-year-old pastor resigned his pulpit for after receiving arson charges.
Oh, no.
He's out on a $5,000 bond. At least he's poor man.
Diligent. He's busy. Keeping busy.
But, you know, you'd think with such an active weekend and also a very tragic weekend in Philadelphia over the 4th of July holiday that that's just about all we would have seen going on. But also, Trev, aliens.
No way. Come on. 1947. Is that Roswell?
According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, flying discs seen over city. And I bet you're wondering, Trev, yeah, sure, people saw the flying saucers or flying pie pans, as they were also called, in a term that died off in clear favor of saucers.
I like flying pie pans more.
You're probably thinking, these people were crazy. And I'll have you know that just because one of the people listed as having witnessed flying pie pans in the sky was a junior intern at the Pennsylvania Hospital for Mental Diseases at 44th and Market does not make this any more less legitimate of a story.
Was it like a Hair Club for Men situation where they weren't just an intern but also a patient?
You know, we have no idea if the patients had taken over the asylum in an attempt to start a rumor about aliens landing in Philadelphia. But no, several aircraft were seen over Philadelphia, according to the newspaper, at the point where these aerial objects were viewed in West Philadelphia. They might have come from the park with the wind. The Army and the Navy were participating more or less in the park celebration. However, spokesmen concerned with the park fiesta said they knew of no arrangements under which free or test balloons or any other aerial objects were released in the park just before sunset.
Imagining the Army and the Navy being involved in the 4th of July scenario and then just like, yeah, let's release some balloons. And the experimental kind that no one can recognize. Why not? Let's just go nuts.
You know what makes me proud to be an American? My ability to release balloons unchecked from this military facility.
It is a generally underused freedom that those in our military have, is that they can just launch balloons at any time.
So an active 4th of July holiday in Philadelphia, goodness, you might say, Trev. And that's before we even get to the doubleheader the Phillies let slip through their fingers on July 4th. And we'll get to that right after this break. Well, Trev, the Phillies had an important question to ask themselves in early July 1947. Can you imagine what that question was?
When can we go home?
Yeah, close. The question was, why are we sucking and how can we stop?
Did they really want to know how can they stop? This is the 1940s Phillies. I think they just kind of, you know, they maybe wanted to know for intellectual reasons why they sucked so they could, you know, refine it or send warnings to the rest of the league about how not to suck. But they never really planned on not sucking, right?
If you're asking me if I'm paraphrasing, I would answer that with how dare you? and absolutely. But in my defense, you know, that the headline reads that the Phillies management went into a huddle over, quote, inability of club to win games. So more or less.
What's the diagnosis, Doc?
They had just returned from a road trip, and they kind of broke down a couple of key points here. The Phils returned home yesterday with a road trip record of 4 victories and 11 defeats. The batters have been somewhat less than adequate in driving in runs. No statistics supplied to back that up, but I think it's only fair to believe that it's true.
Yes.
Seven of nine pitchers have been able to win only 9 games among them. Look, I know we don't really treasure the pitcher win anymore, but back then this was is it fair to say that it was a more accurate statistic back then in an era where pitchers were going for ideally 9 innings and responsible for more of the action?
I mean, it's probably a little closer to something like quarterback wins, where you look at something like, you know, what is the most important and sort of like directly impactful member of the team if they play the whole game, starting pitcher. If they get the win, does that mean that they pitched well every time? No. If they get the losses, it means they pitched poorly every time? No. But it's a little more accurate than, like, you know, I pitched 0-run ball for 6 innings, and then, like, I accidentally left one guy on, and some dude with a, you know, a 10.3 ERA gave up a 2-run home run immediately, and I got a loss. I think if you pitch the whole game, yeah, it's a little more accurate. It tells you a little more.
All right. See, I think that I think that's a good time to launch our the pitcher wins are actually good and we're bringing them back campaign.
It's time. The people have asked, and you know, I'm really proud of our campaign because the main way that we focus on bringing pitcher wins back into the zeitgeist is by saying they should be used in arbitration hearings, which we also think are good.
Oh yeah, I definitely think pitchers should only be paid. I think the amount of wins they have should dictate how much money they make.
Yeah. Also, they should be paid less than me.
Yes. Also, I should get a lot of money for having no losses on the season.
You've never had a loss, actually.
Yeah, I've never. Yes, that is accurate. Unlike Philadelphia on July 4th, 1947, no losses whatsoever over here. Also, in regards to the Phillies, they had used 7 men at first base already in the season.
Is that legal? Can you do that? Can you just like play 7 people at first base at once? It's a weird defensive position.
Kept stacking them on top of each other like Lego men. Maybe this will work. Rules say it's only one guy. If we only give one of them shoes.
I like the idea of someone just going completely nuts and trying just terrible shifts, like 7 guys just standing all the way around first base. Like, well, if you can't get to first base, then...
Nice try, pal. We're 1947 first basemen. We hammer railroad spikes into the ground in the off season, and it's not for the railroad company. You know what I'm saying? Also listed as some of the short club's shortcomings, they were plagued with a long list of major and minor injuries, if that sounds at all familiar.
No,
and
I don't know what you'd be talking about there.
Frankly, this all sounds pretty familiar, except for the, not first base specifically, but...
First base has been the one place where there's actually been kind of some consistency for the Phillies.
Stability. Even before 2019, which is considered like that turnaround year. Yeah, I do feel, I mean, not first base, but I feel like, you know, some years you get hit pretty hard at one particular position. And the Phillies got hit this year pretty hard at middle infield, without a doubt. I mean, this was pretty desperate times. We were looking at a Sean Rodriguez situation.
Listen, that was always the plan. He's an amazing player and an up and comer. He currently is 2007, and I'm speaking to you somehow from the past.
Yeah, I think we left you back there during one of our previous episodes. Oh, Sean Rodriguez, what are you doing here? Well, 2007, it makes total sense that I'm here. What are you doing here? Oh, he's right. Well, in any case, this was the same old story, frankly. And management had to, like, go behind closed doors and look at each other and be like, we just lost 26 of our last 38 games going into July 1st. And that was after we had been only one game from the top of the National League with only a 15-13 record. But still, they were far from struggling until, again, they dropped. They dropped 26 of 38 games going into a game against the Dodgers, who were, you know, pretty ready to beat a team that had sucked that much of late.
Yeah.
And according to the Associated Press, management's meeting was basically to just console each other over what the paper called, quote, a sad, sad total of misery.
Wow.
If you, you've got to repeat the word sad to describe the current state of your ball club. Not good.
Sad, not, comma, sad, comma, again may I say sad.
And once more I tell you sad. Sad.
It is funny because, I mean, like, this year's team is certainly not that hopeless, but on some level, because they had such high expectations, it feels that hopeless.
Yes, and again, newspapers of this era were much more accurate in their portrayals of misery by using the word misery, whereas these days, you know, you're gonna get a lot more. You're gonna get one of probably like five or six vocab words from a professional word bank that baseball writers are gonna use to describe the team. You know, so
well they can't say anything else, or else, you know, some whoever is managing the Mets at that point will find them with their friend Jason Vargas and tell them that they're big time trouble and they're not welcome in the clubhouse anymore.
They're going to flip a chair over, break off one of its legs, and be like, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow in hell.
I see you used I see you used unmotivated instead of sluggish as a word here. I'll show you unmotivated. Unmotivated to move once I sever your spinal column.
It's a wonderful sport played by nothing but best of friends.
Gentlemen, yeah.
Well, this was also 1947. It was also the first year the Phillies entered a 10-year deal with the city of Clearwater, Florida, to conduct their spring training activities down there earlier in the season, a couple months before this game. A deal that has obviously sustained to this day, the longest, I believe, deal between a Major League Baseball team and a city to serve as its spring training facility.
Now you say obviously. Why is that obvious?
Is this, do I need to actually answer this?
No, you don't
actually. No, okay.
That's cool though. That's neat.
You have a very serious doctor's tone, and sometimes it is difficult to
read. This has been happening recently where people don't know if I'm joking and they'll answer my joke questions and I have to stop them. But yeah, no, that's cool. I like Clearwater. Obviously, is a nice place to play baseball, and I think.
Oh, have you played a lot of baseball in Clearwater?
Yeah, I have.
Please expand on that.
My name is Alex Rodriguez, and I gotta come with a lie. I'm married to Jennifer Lopez, and
that checks out.
I am a very good shortstop, and at times third baseman. Although I'm currently retired.
Interesting. Well, a quick Google search shows that all checks out. So, all right, that answers my question. Have you ever been to Clearwater at all, Dr. Trevor?
No, but I've watched a lot of spring training on TV, and like it does seem pleasant. Like it seems like it's a nice field. It seems like they sort of have a decent setup. It's not too, I don't know, it's not too like cavalier. So it's like, you know, just like a joke, but it's not a it's not so serious that people aren't having fun. It hits a really nice balance.
Yeah, it's got its own culture. People are, you know, they're so lucky that not lucky, but it's so.
I walk here until like Clearwater residents. You're lucky, you know.
Well, I'm just more looking at how it's the period of baseball where people are so grateful to have baseball back. Nobody's burned out by it. People are so excited. I saw Charlie Manuel tweeting about like, oh, I can't wait to go to this like diner in Clearwater that they all always go to, like old Phillies people are always going to, and like getting the specials, and like they all have their routines down there. But also Clearwater and other small Florida towns like that are getting baseball and fans from out of town who give this economic boon, but are also just really excited about baseball. And honestly, We talk about how bad baseball does in Florida in regards to the Rays and the Marlins, and it is bad. It is really dumb and bad.
It's super bad. Yeah, it's not good.
The Rays getting moved halfway to Montreal is you know,
and not even in the cool. I'm gonna send you halfway to Montreal. Like I'm gonna punch Iowa. You so hard you're gonna end up in Montreal, but only halfway. Iowa's yeah, the cool way to halfway.
I mean.
Very cool.
I mean, look, Florida's compromise with baseball might just have to be that they get a month of half the teams in baseball coming down there when it's still fresh and fun and the games don't really matter and people are just down there to have drinks with little umbrellas in them and eat cheap hot dogs at single-A stadiums and just have a great old time. You know, maybe that plus like the Florida State League is all the baseball Florida needs. It certainly seems like it's all the baseball Florida wants. I don't know.
I don't really know. I've been why down to Clearwater. More. Yeah, I mean, it's not as if the Marlins and the Rays are really giving anyone any happy feelings. Just enjoy spring training. And then I don't know, like go watch the Dolphins or something. I don't know.
Like the
just angry like at
the animals or the football team?
You know, it could be either.
Okay.
You know, but you know, if you're into sports, maybe the football team.
That's good advice, Trevor. If you are down in Florida and you're done watching baseball, then yeah, go find some of the Miami Dolphins who will not be playing football because it won't be in season yet. But find some of the individual Miami Dolphins.
Just look at them
And just go, just check them out, see what they're up to.
Don't
what are they
talk
like?
To them.
Don't my don't God, spook don't. Them. Do not approach them. That's for a professional. But yeah, if you can monitor their activity from across a street,
it's very tragic though. If you approach a Miami Dolphin and speak to them, it's true the coach will not take them back.
Yeah, that's accurate.
They know that a human has touched them, and
yeah, do not get your scent. Sad. Yeah, don't get your musk on one of the dolphins. That's only fair.
Why there are so many extremely tall, muscular men walking around Miami?
It's crazy that more people don't know this.
Well, you know, you got to spread the word.
Well, 1947, the Phillies, of course, lost their first ever spring training game in Clearwater to the Dodgers 13-1.
Ugh.
Things are looking up.
1947 does not sound like a fun year to be a Phillies fan.
Oh, it sucked. They finished in last place.
Ah, well, good.
The Phillies and Clearwater, as I said, have maintained the longest association of any MLB team with its preseason town and typically bring in about $70 million to the local economy when they come down every March. This spring, Trevor, it was only about $44 million. Where that extra $26 million?
Oof, good math. Seamless.
Where'd it go, Trev? Do you have it?
Right into my pocket. Now
I'm
rich.
I knew it. Well, they were trying to figure out what happened when the Tampa Bay Times asked a few experts because it became clear that the reason for the disparity was probably because of the idea of you know, something like concepts like stadium impact being basically horse shit. One guy told them that local resident they were talking about how one X factor in counting how much money has come in during this period was like you couldn't just count all of the money that was being spent at businesses in Clearwater during the month of March just because the Phillies were down there, because this guy was saying, you know, maybe a local resident is there spending money. That's not money coming into the community. It's money just staying in the community. So he says that local resident is spending money at the baseball stadium rather than at the local bar and restaurant,
right,
rather than at the local movie theater. That's not money that is new to the city. That's money that's just shifting around.
Yeah, and it reminds me of when people, like, there was a brief sort of, like, no one remembers this anymore, but there was a brief back and forth with the politicians in Chicago, in like the Wrigleyville area in Chicago when I was there, where like the Cubs kind of like hollowly threatened to move to like a northern suburb. They're like, we'll move.
We'll
start
it.
Playing our games elsewhere, not the historic stadium that gets us all our money. And all the local businesses were like, if they do that, we'll die. It's like, well, sure.
We'll do it. We'll burn Wrigley to the ground. You'll see.
I think, like, it's funny.
We will do that.
Wink. Yeah, just like, I've always thought of, like, yes, it would be a huge impact. I wonder how much of an impact it is. And I think like probably there's a lot of measuring like that where they're like, well, I made this much money between April and August, or like I made this much money between April and October, which is like earmarked as baseball money. I'd lose all that. People aren't like, turns out people aren't always good accountants, I guess, is the moral of this story.
Yeah, you did find a couple of people who were a little defensive about this.
Cool.
Yeah, the Phillies, one guy, the Clearwater Parks and Recreation Director, said, frankly, no, like we didn't expect there to be that much of a swing. But he finishes up the article by saying, like, I'm an eye test kind of guy. The Philadelphia sports fan is coming down here in droves. It's like, I'm not going to check the numbers. I can see the highway from here. We're fine.
He's like, he's one of those guys that, like, you'd tell him the number of jelly beans and he guessed the number of jelly beans jar. And he'd be like, eye test doesn't agree. 26,500. I think it's more like 14,600, and that's what I guessed, so I think I'm right.
I see 70 million in there, then frankly I see no reason to question that.
It's like it's like my daughter's eye test. It's like a 5-year-old's version of an eye test. How much really is that? It's a billion. It's actually 120. I don't know. Looks like a billion to me.
Who knows what 120 looks like, Dad? So answer me that. Why don't you? This cracks me up. The city actually spent $15,000 for a research firm to come up with the $44 million figure. Like,
don't spend money to make money. That's not nice.
Spend money to lose money.
You're a town.
Millions of dollars.
You're a city. Don't do that. Have some respect.
The Phillies head of Florida operations was like, hang on, do they even, like, for example, count how much money players spend in the local communities when they're down here? Yeah, that's right. Didn't think of that, did you?
They have to buy breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
It said in the Times, this guy's name is John Timberlake, it says, for example, Timberlake pointed out the spending of Phillies players who have a second home in Clearwater is not counted. I've never seen any numbers that came out of in this neighborhood, Timberlake said of the study. So that seemed in the report seemed to be like his sole point. And Clearwater's mayor was also rather defensive. This is from the article. Mayor George Kritikos said the Phillies, which have trained in Clearwater since 1947, give a year-round economic boost that can't necessarily be captured in a report about 1 year of spring training. The director of Parks and Recreation, his last name was Dunbar, for his part, described a typical day at Clearwater Beach during spring training. Take a trip down the Memorial Causeway in March and you're greeted with wall-to-wall red team gear. And that's what he says, the eye test kind of guy thing. So
sounds kind of scary.
Everybody seemed a little protective. The fact that I would have been like, no, I'm on your guys' side. I'm more wondering where the money go. And the conclusion, well, something of a conclusion seemed to be drawn that, like, oh no, it's not that the money's not there, it's that we've just been counting it wrong. And
this is really the worst possible conclusion. It's the most accountant possible conclusion there is, where it's like, well,
it's kind of wacky. Like, if this was a movie, then, like, you know, you're going to have like a mayor played by Danny DeVito is not only like taking $26 million for his own money, but also like, you know, shutting down a dog shelter.
Yeah.
Or like turning it into a kill shelter or something like that.
This is like the accountant's dream of being the hero of the movie, where like instead of, you know, Jack Ryan coming in and saving it with like espionage and violence, an accountant's like, hang on, I just read these papers. There's a line at it where there shouldn't be one.
Oh, you're talking about The Accountant with Ben Affleck.
But in The Accountant with Ben Affleck, he's secretly also like a secret agent super spy. This would be The Accountant where he's like, my secret, I'm very good at counting and accounting for things.
That's not a secret. Your job is accountant. But yeah, this is like
I'm
the first
very good at.
This is the first 20 minutes of The Accountant. Before he sniper shots two men's faces off of their bodies.
Every accountant in the audience is like, ugh, come on.
No, I hate that movie.
Yeah, just like for the first 20 minutes, they're so into it. And then he does that and they're like, oh, they always do this.
It's a total misconception of what my job
is. I've never had to do that.
Well, this was also the season in which horrific racist Ben Chapman would be the manager of the Phillies and attract the league's attention by viciously heckling Jackie Robinson in late April. Commissioner Happy Chandler wanted Chapman to face repercussions. He was a sad Chandler that day, which is, I believe, how Chapman wound up taking that infamous photograph of himself and Jackie Robinson as a means of, like, oh, we mended fences, but, like, clearly... like, neither one of them wanted to take the picture, and you can tell that because it's a picture. Things were looking up, though. The Phillies had Schoolboy Row going for them against the Giants on July 4th, 1947. You know, they'd come into July not looking too great. That all the reasons listed by the Associated Press that had management kind of closing the door and screaming, "What the ever-loving God is going on here?" Or screaming, "What sort of God would allow this?"
What in our dark, dark Lord's secret vessel is going on here?
After losing 26 of 38, but they had Schoolboy Row going for him against the Giants in the doubleheader on July 4th. No one had died yet in Philadelphia. The exhibition at Gimbel's department store had shown a bright future ahead for the city of Philadelphia. And why don't you head on down to Scheib Park and check out this doubleheader the Phillies are going to be playing against the friggin' Braves. So just, I know I just said Giants, I meant Braves. So why don't we head on down to Scheib Park right after this break? Well, Trev, it's about time we head on down to the game.
Yay, I've been waiting. I'm stuck in traffic.
Philadelphia is because of those horses running into the street.
Yeah, that's right. I missed the Star Spangled Banner where the singer at the end said, "Happy July 4th, no one's going to die, and everyone's going to have a fun time at this game."
I mean, you know, nothing tells me no one's going to die like someone getting 10 cc's of blood drained from their elbow, which is exactly what had happened to Schoolboy Row after he had... you know, mentioned he might be having a throwing issue, and well, he was just right as rain after that.
That's class. That's original Tommy John surgery.
Well, we just let him bleed.
Yeah, why don't we take some blood out of his elbow?
It's got too much in there. That's the problem.
Ooh, yeah. Doc's diagnosed with blood elbow.
Yeah, just hold down his arm, and I'll get my gun.
Now we're gonna have to shoot very carefully to get a small
hole. I said hold still. Plus, the All-Star game was essentially here. For the first time in 14 years, the fans were permitted to vote for the starting nine in each league again. Huzzah! Ben Chapman was going to be the assistant coach, and Schoolboy Row was headed to the aforementioned Wrigley Field, with second baseman Emil Verbin and Harry Walker an outfielder. So the Phillies had quite a representation at the All-Star game, despite being destined for last place and a 62-92 record.
Thinking about Harry Walker and how funny of a name that is.
After this doubleheader sweep at the hands of the Braves, they would lose twice to the Giants, then win five of their next seven, and then lose eight of their next 10.
Oh, no.
So things never got quite right for this team.
That's great. And that's not good.
In both of these games, both of these doubleheaders, the Phillies faced a pair of hurlers who were both went all nine innings and completely shut them down. They were absolutely helpless at the hands of both Johnny Sain and Walt LaFranconi. And Johnny Sain,
two household names.
Johnny Sain pitched game one in kind of in some households must be a household name because he's kind of alongside some pretty illustrious companions. I'm sure some people are screaming into their listening devices right now.
Some of our listeners who are alive in 1947 and watching baseball.
Johnny Sain to me sounded like what the name a hitchhiker would give you who you picked up outside of an asylum. Why? What's my name, you ask? What? Johnny Sain. Johnny, totally sane. Here for the ride. Johnny Sain joined Johnny Pesky and Ted Williams, as well as some other Hall of Famers, down in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where they wound up fielding what was probably the best team in the country at the time in May 1943. They were down there to do some military training, having had their numbers called. Ted Williams, Johnny Pesky, Joe Coleman, and Buddy Grimp were all down there. They called them a bunch of Yankees and Indians players who were pretty much running the table as far as baseball was concerned.
Yeah, I bet.
The Cloudbuster Nine, and there's a pretty good book about them that's, I think, called The Cloudbuster Nine. It's one of those interesting baseball books in which baseball plays a key role, but not the only role, and that's the kind of narrative I'm into.
What else is going on in 1943?
Well, I'm glad you asked. How many horses escaped in 1943?
Please, lead with how many people died in the weeks you are talking about here. Classic journalist tactic.
Well, Johnny Sain wound up training flyboys in Corpus Christi, Texas for the remainder of World War II, so he was relatively safe. His saber profile says that he benefited from his time away from baseball because it allowed his arm to rest, which doesn't feel quite like an even trade, baseball health, in exchange for being drafted into military service.
He didn't have to kill anyone, though.
Yeah, he says he didn't leave the country. Yeah, he seems so. That's okay. He's known very well for being a perfect complement to fellow starter Warren Spahn, who was the impetus for the poem that appeared in September 1948, written by a newspaper editor at the Boston Post. First we'll use Spahn, and then we'll use Sain, then an off day, followed by rain. Back will come Spahn, followed by Sain, and followed, we hope, by 2 days of rain. So I think this guy, Jerry Hearn, This newspaper editor, I think he came up with a fun rhyme, and then you could just put that in the newspaper.
Just really, really leaned on that rhyme. writing that for the New York Times. I'm the editor of the New York Times. Like, publish this.
Boston Post, but still.
Publish this at the front of the newspaper, please.
Put this on the front page. Is this a poem? Yeah, I wrote it last night. Did you know Sain rhymes with rain?
They have to do it. I'm the boss.
Sain's mechanic father taught. Sorry, his father was a mechanic.
I was going to say, was he a robot dad?
He didn't have like a bucket-headed robot for a father. Sain's father, who was a mechanic, taught him to throw a curveball, something he used to find the success he had playing baseball. That became his weapon of choice. In fact, playing in an exhibition game, a war relief exhibition game, I believe as a part of the Cloudbuster Nine, he was facing a 48-year-old Babe Ruth at Yankee Stadium. And somebody told him. Somebody came to the mound and told him, "Hey, don't use your curveball against Babe's. You don't want to upset him." Because it was kind of a moment. He was 48. He'd been coaching third base. He'd come in for an at bat. It was Babe Ruth batting at Yankee Stadium. Nobody wanted to see Babe Ruth strike out on a curveball. And as Johnny Sain said later, taking away my curveball was like cutting off two of my fingers. But it was Babe Ruth in Yankee Stadium. So he grooved the old guy a couple of fastballs in order to keep his emotions in check. And I think Babe Ruth got a hold of him, one of them. Scouts and coaches tried to actually talk Johnny Sain out of playing baseball. Bill Terry tried to convince him to leave and go do other things. But no, Sain agreed to a $5 Class D contract somewhere in the Boston Red Sox organization. Then he somehow became a part of both the Red Sox and the Tigers organizations. That happened too. No one really was sure how. But he branded Classic himself as baseball. A pitcher. Branded himself as a pitcher with guile and sneakiness, knowing he couldn't blow people away. I mean, how many guys can you really think of who dominated in this fashion? You had Jamie Moyer. I'm sure a ton of others, but
Greg Maddux.
More so, yeah, they're just kind of singled out for that.
Jason Vargas.
It's a much harder job to do when you got to save your unhinged rage for the clubhouse and reporters in it, rather than throwing your fastball 97 miles an hour.
Jamie Moyer We harp on Carlos Santana a lot, but if given the opportunity to smash a bunch of TVs, Jamie Moyer would have been an absolute nightmare.
Oh yeah, you could just see it in his face.
Yeah, he wants to reduce them to ash.
Running charities for children's health? No thanks. Give me a room full of televisions and a hammer, and I'll show you the real Jamie Moyer. That's right. Well, clearly, Johnny Sain had the temperament of a fireballer, as this story about his relationship with his manager, Billy Southworth, tells us in Sain's delightfully written saber biography by Jan Finkel. It wasn't just Sain's ailing shoulder at fault. Almost everything went wrong for the Braves in 1949. Billy Southworth, whose demands were grudgingly accepted when his teams were winning, reportedly became intolerable during spring training, claiming credit the players considered theirs and breaking rules that he had set. Southworth put the defending National League champs through two-a-day sessions that totaled 6 hours and instituted a midnight curfew complete with room checks by a clubhouse attendant and watchdog Shorty Young. So Sane was typically in bed by 9:30 at this point. It seems like, you know, he wasn't a problem. But still, this guy Shorty Young checked in on Sane only one time. And in doing so, he managed to wake him out of a sound sleep. Ugh. And Sane was furious, saying that if it had ever happened again, he'd throw him out the window.
Wow.
So rumor got out that Southworth had checked up on Johnny Sane.
And he was dead.
And that Sane had threatened to throw him out the window, and that Sane and Southworth weren't speaking. So for his part, Sane said he never socialized with his managers, which is an excellent response.
Certainly makes sense to me, honestly. I don't know why you would.
Did you threaten to kill your manager? No, I have never spoken to my manager. that's way more sane.
I'm Johnny Sane.
I'm Johnny Sane. Well, Johnny Sane went through some dark times. His career started going south, but he underwent some radiation treatment on his shoulder and bounced back to pitch for the Yankees for a couple of years. He retired and became a very vaunted pitching coach and very well respected. Mm. He got along so well with his pitchers and turned around a lot of their careers, but he lashed with at least two of his managers, including Mayo Smith of the Tigers. And then his wife divorced him and put him in bankruptcy. Then the pitchers he worked with loved him. They'd seem to flourish under his guidance, then seek out jobs elsewhere. The managers liked him a little less, ownership too, as he was he had a habit of trying to get pitchers to demand to be paid what they felt they were worth.
Classic mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that.
Please make the money we give you and nothing else. Thank you. He also invented a pitching machine, not the pitching machine, but a pitching machine. This is from The Head Game by Roger Kahn. The Yankees hired Sane in 1961 as pitching coach. He showed up with a briefcase full of inspirational books and tapes and a machine he was patenting as the baseball pitching educational device, which everyone soon called the baseball spinner. Baseballs were mounted on rotating axes, one axis per ball, and you could snap one in a variety of fastball spins and the other in rotations for sliders and curves. The baseballs were anchored. Except for rotating, they didn't move. Using John Sane's baseball pitching educational device, you could practice spinning your delivery at home or in a taxi or in a hotel room without endangering lamps, mirrors, or companions.
It sounds kind of cool, actually. It sounds like a neat little object.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time, you know, picturing it.
Yeah, the part where it only can rotate and nothing else is very weird to me.
And they said you could do it in a taxi, which changed my vision of its size.
Yeah, how would you swing a bat in a taxi?
I think it was for pitchers.
Only for pitchers?
I have no idea.
Weird.
That's strange.
Anyway.
It was Johnny Sane who, all this illustrious career activity had yet to befall him. This was 1947, July 4th. He got the ball in game one of a doubleheader against the Phillies, who again were awful. And Johnny Sane wound up having a hell of a game. You know, he pitched all nine innings. Like I said, he allowed 11 hits, two earned runs, two walks, seven strikeouts. He faced 41 batters and generally kept the Phillies in check for a 10-3 victory by his Boston Braves at Scheib Park. The inning in question where he really got some help from his offense was the top of the fifth, when the Braves were already up 3-0.
Come on, guys, no one to stop.
They let the Braves lead off the inning with a single to third on a bunt.
A single to third on a bunt.
Yeah, by Danny Littweiler, followed by Bob Elliott, who came up. He singled to left field.
On a bunt.
Frank McCormick did bunt. This was an actual sacrifice. Managed to put both runners in scoring position with one out.
Love to do a sacrifice when I'm going to win a game 10-3.
Yeah, they were only up 3-0 against the terrifying Phillies offense. But this was the 3, 4, and 5 hitters. So it was the 5 hitter who sacrificed bunt. 2 out of 3 of them bunted.
So
the third
mad
one on a purposeful sacrifice. Connie Ryan came up next, and he was intentionally walked by the Phillies pitcher, someone named It Doesn't Matter. Sibby Sisti came up next.
Sibby Sisti?
Yes, Sibby Sisti.
Say it five times fast.
I will be accepting no questions at this time. He singled to left field. That knocked two runs in. Ryan wound up on second base. With Hank Camelli batting then, Ryan steals third base. Sisti stole second base on a double steal, which led to yet another intentional walk on the part for Hank Camelli. That brought up the pitcher, Johnny Sain.
Oh, no.
And I bet I know what you're thinking, that with the bases loaded and a pitcher batting, I mean, yeah, they probably have him bunt, since apparently it's good enough for their three-hole hitter and their five-hole
just
hitter.
Everyone why not bunt? Just have, why not everyone?
Why not just bunt and see what happens at this point? You already got a single and two runners in scoring
position.
Probably
could bunt a home run.
But no, he just simply took advantage of the Swiss cheese the Phillies' defense was at this point. And he singled to left field. Ryan came in to score. Sisti came in to score. Camelli went to third base thanks to an error on the throw.
Brutal.
So that brought up Nanny Fernandez, who grounded out but knocked in a run. Sain ran to second base. Mike McCormick was up next. He tripled the center field, scoring Sain. But Sain, thankfully, scored the last run of the inning. But at this point, Braves are up 9-0. Happy Independence Day. Hope you'll stick around.
My hobby of baseball.
So hope you'll stick around to Shibe Park to watch the fireworks after the game. Oh, right, it's the middle of the day, and also the stadium's made out of extremely dry wood. So
go
let's
home.
Just be, everybody just go home. My God, have you heard what's going on in this city? Go home. Be
Lock
safe.
Your
be
doors.
With your families.
Horses are going to get you.
Well, after the 10-3 loss in the first game, the Phillies came back out for the second against the Braves, and boy, this time they didn't even wait more than an inning to go down. Walt Lanfranconi pitched this one. He is not someone who wound up being particularly well-known.
Not
actually.
A lot of information out there on him, I'm betting.
No, there was actually much less. The interesting thing about him is that his space that happened in the middle of his career. He started his career in 1941, actually facing the Phillies as a pitcher for the as a pitcher for those famous Chicago Cubs at the age of 24.
Of I was trying to come up with who it might have been, but.
Yes. Well, that year he threw six innings in one start, appearing in two games. And then he didn't play again until he was 30 years old. Yeah, he threw one inning on September 12th in 1941. On September 24th, they let him pitch again, this time for five
innings.
He
was a spy during World War II.
And he didn't play again until 1947, probably because of all the spying he did. All right, we'll let you back, but you can't play professional baseball for 6 years.
No.
All right, you can play regular baseball, just not in the pros.
Okay.
Always, for some reason, he was born in the town of, I'm going to say, it's either pronounced Bear or Barry. It's spelled B-A-R-R-E, and I know as a part of Wilkes-Barre.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I've heard that both ways, too.
Yeah, I think it's Bar, like, around here, it's Wilkes-Barre. So, okay. I don't know. Whatever.
Well, let's say Barr, Vermont. He was always, this fact was cited everywhere, that he was a son of Barr, Vermont. Like, this was,
it's
huge
deal. Probably a place with not a lot of sons.
And maybe he just didn't have a lot of characteristics that they were going to cite. But this was a distinguishment that seemed to really mean something to people in this day and age. He would go on to become beloved by his hometown fans, who helped raise funds in order to throw a Lanfranconi Day at the end of the season on September 9th, 1947, as he was retiring, which gave him, they wound up giving him a convertible sedan as a gift, and even got the local Burlington Cardinals business manager, who I only bring up because his name was Fuzzy Evans, to throw in some cash.
Yeah.
The day of the event, the local paper wrote that there would be five train cars waiting to take fans down to the ballpark for the occasion, and according to his hometown paper, he squeezed the most out of his natural talents by putting them through the ringer of hard work and courage. So, yeah, I mean, he did serve in the military, which does explain his absence from baseball. Spied. Baseball Reference lists it as he was, you know, military service, so he wasn't around. But it was harder than it sounds for him to join, to have that military service. Apparently, he went to enlist with the Navy and the Marines. Both of them, initially at least, turned him down. The Burlington Free Press explained this as bad teeth.
Not good.
I mean, they got to be pretty bad teeth.
I mean,
to keep
maybe
you out of.
Maybe it's like how you test horses. You look in their mouth and you check their gums and stuff. You're like, I don't want this one.
If there's one thing our soldiers are doing in World War II, it's smiling and photographs. And we can't have someone like you in there
chomping on big carrots and alfalfa cubes.
Well, Walt got a boost just in the first inning when the Braves came up. Tommy Holmes, facing Philly starter Dutch Leonard, singled, followed by Johnny Hop, who hit another single. Bama Rowell came up again. He grounded out to second base, but moved
none
up the runners.
None of these people are real.
Yeah, Bob, tell me about it. Bob Elliott, then he grounded out as well, but it managed to get Holmes in and score. Earl Torgerson came up next.
Whoa.
This is what really makes this the dirty inning of this game. He hits a single to center field. Elliott scores. He advances on an error on the center fielder, so no RBI is counted.
Not fair
then,
to Torgerson.
Then Torgerson scores on the play as well, even though he was batting due to an error on the third baseman. So that run was also unearned.
Does that at bat count? Like, does all those
the
errors,
I don't know if
seems
the inning,
like you should just, like, erase it.
I don't know if the inning counts, frankly.
It's like, yeah, it's like one of those unexplainable things. You're like, wow, it's just better off that we just, let's just erase this from the.
Let's hope no one talks about this in great detail.
I'm really worried that people are going to ask questions we can't answer.
It's my chief concern. I can't stop thinking about it. Well, that was one of two three-run innings the Braves put up in the first three innings of that game. They wound up winning 7-1, sweeping the Phillies in a doubleheader in Philadelphia, the birthplace of America, on America's birthday. To his credit, Walt Bonfrancone went all nine innings as well. He only allowed four hits. And one earned run. He did walk four, but he left that game with a 2.61 ERA. Pretty fine final season at 30 years old with Boston. He only appeared in, he appeared in 36 games with a 2.95 ERA. And then he didn't pitch in professional Major League Baseball ever again.
It's because he
so
got the
nice
dossier he needed from his manager. And then from Johnny Sane. And then
from the dashboard of the convertible or the glove compartment of the convertible they gave him on Lanfranconi Day.
Used an umbrella to inject a laudanum pill into like Johnny Pips, killing him instantly.
Killing him instantly. but that's a story for another day.
No, that, I'm not even
that
tired,
is the,
Grandpa.
Well. They only played and lost two stupid baseball games on this particular July 4th, 1947, and we are happy to bring you stories of this nature, as well as many others, on The Dirty Inning, your favorite Phillies podcast, on which we go back and talk about the most obscure, dumbest, strangest, or idiotic innings in Philadelphia Phillies history.
Emphasis on idiotic.
Be sure to subscribe, download, and rate all the podcasts that are a part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Season with John Stolness, as well as Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher. And then there's plenty of bonus content on the Patreon as well, which is at patreon.com/hittenseason. Thank you so much for listening to The Dirty Inning. I hope you've had a frank and restful All-Star break. It's going to be a hectic frenzy of activity for the Phillies in the second half.
Won't.
You'll see it all. See it all at The Good Fight. And we will talk to you next time on
The Dirty Inning.
The Dirty
Inning.
The Dirty Inning.